This podcast is brought to you by Workle, a platform helping people get happier at work. Find out more at workle.co. Work happier.
You know, really all I wanted to do was grow vegetables. This was the 80s, and if your shoulder pads were big enough, you could do anything. I felt so much more comfortable talking to those farmers about farming and food than I ever did trying to flog the highly dubious services of a company that I worked for. That moment, I just said, nope, I don't want this, and said, I'm leaving. I wanted to go and make my own way in the world. I stank of cow shit. I just didn't have a girlfriend. And it was really, really tough. And looking back, I worked ridiculous hours, you know, 70-hour weeks as a matter of course. And I was exhausted and I was miserable.
Welcome to the Happy Work Life podcast, where people with inspiring careers reflect on how happy they have been in their working lives. On this podcast, we hear from a range of people working in business, startups, science, academia, media, healthcare, fashion, and much more, and find out which roles gave them the most satisfaction and, importantly, what they have done to get happier at work. So sit down with me, Mark Price, founder of Workle, to help you get happier at work. Workle is the platform where you can find a job in the happiest companies, take our happiness test, network, and get career support from experts, and much, much more. On this edition of the Happy Work Life podcast, I'm delighted to be joined by Guy Singh Watson. Now, Guy set up Riverford Organic. He started it over 30 years ago as a farmer who saw an idea to deliver veg boxes locally and then nationally. He's twice won the BBC Radio 4 Farmer of the Year award. He knows everything there is to know about organic farming. He believes strongly that organic food should be for everybody, not just for the elite. Beside all those remarkable things, including building Riverford Organics, he also, in 2018, decided that he was going to sell the business to his employees at a knockdown price. He sold at the time about three quarters, and then as recently as May 2023, he sold the remainder. And now Riverford Organic is 100% employee owned, thanks to the generosity of Guy. Guy, it's really lovely to have you on the podcast. You've done some incredible things in your life, but I want to start, if I can, in your early years. Was there anything in your background growing up that led you to believe that you were going to be a farmer and grower and then become a retail entrepreneur and ride on the wave of the internet and then do remarkable philanthropic things in terms of ultimately what you decided to do with your business? So was any of that in your early days?
I think it was all laid down pretty early. Of course, I was unaware of it, but I mean, it was laid in terms of I always wanted to be a farmer because that's what my dad did, and that's, I guess, where status was in our household. It was all around getting things done. And I just wanted to be involved with the farm from, you know, as early as I could remember, as early as I could walk, really. And I do love the farming industry. I love growing food. I love its sort of tangible nature. The sort of values of wanting to do that, not just for the benefit of myself, but wanting to do something which was valuable to others, I think also came from my parents. I think they were part of that post-war generation that was responsible for the welfare state and the NHS and so on. They wanted to create a world fit for heroes. And I think they felt that they had to work together to do that. And I think that's what led my dad to become a farmer at a time of food rationing. So it was inculcated in, the youngest of five, it was inculcated in all of us around the kitchen table that we should do something useful with our lives, and being useful was not measured in how much money you could make. It was measured in how much value you could be to others, really.
And so do you remember working on the farm from your kind of earliest years?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I can. I was out, you know, helping feed the calves and muck out the pigs from as soon as I could get my feet into a pair of wellies, and as were my four siblings.
And what about school? How did you find school?
Well, I was incredibly lucky to go to progressive primary at Dartington, just down the road, which had an incredibly enlightened approach to education. We had the Dartington Hall College and School, which was a sort of free school, private fee-paying school. But some of that ethos, I think, rubbed off on the state primary, and it was just a wonderful place to grow up. Where, and I was actually chronically dyslexic, but I think it's a great credit to my teachers that I didn't really know that until I got to secondary school, because I was not, I wasn't branded a failure, despite the fact I insisted on writing from right to left for quite a long time.
So you're another great example of somebody with dyslexia who's had an incredible business life.
Yeah, but that is a very very common tale, isn't it? But yeah, I am. I don't know what it is about something having to find your own workarounds for things from a very early age is probably quite a good training for being an entrepreneur and doing things your own way.
So when you got to the end of your school days, what was in your head then? Was it always, I'm going to go into farming? Was it that clear for you?
I think I was going through a bit of a teenage rebellion at that time, and maybe I did want to get off the farm. I almost joined the Merchant Navy. I almost became a policeman, actually. And then I applied for medical school, but in the end, at the last minute, decided that I wanted to do agriculture and applied to Oxford and got in and studied agriculture and forestry sciences there, which was perhaps a strange place to do it, but it was actually. It had a big sort of ecological basis to the course, which I think stood me in pretty good stead, actually, for being a, at the cutting edge of organic farming.
And tell us about that, because I mean you are very much a pioneer in organic farming, and you've won so many awards, so many ethical awards, BBC Farmer of the Year twice. So when you were at university and you were studying those things, how did that shape your views about not just your future, but the future of food?
I wasn't massively aware of it at that time. I do remember at university being particularly interested in, well, in the ecological aspect of it. So things like integrated pest management, which, trying to understand the ecology of the pest and the plant rather than just trying to obliterate it with chemicals, that did seem to appeal to me. I was always interested in agriculture's place in society, I suppose, and how that had developed over time. But I don't remember, yeah, I don't remember a big sort of rejection of conventional agriculture, I suppose. I mean, by that time, my father was reevaluating how he had farmed. I mean, he'd been at the cutting edge of what was the Green Revolution in the 60s, and we'd even been a demonstration farm for ICI. But by the time we got the 70s and 80s, he was seeing the effect that was having on the soils on the farm. We have some pretty marginal, not massively inherently fertile land, and it was going backwards, and he was looking around for other ways of farming. He was never an organic farmer, but he was supportive of my transition to being organic.
And in terms of then the end of your university days, was it sort of set in stone that you would go back to the family farm? Is that what you had in mind at that point?
Well, my father always wanted to let us do what we wanted to do with our lives, so there was never any overt pressure, but I think sort of underneath there was a thing that this was the most valuable thing you could possibly do with your life. And indeed, all five of us are back on the farm now,
Yeah.
40 years later, 40, 50 years later, running our various businesses and so on. So that's probably a reflection of the values they instilled in us. But I came back to the farm more or less straight from university, and there was a couple of years of vying with my older brother, who was also up for and taking on the tenancy. It was Church of England tenancy, and I realized, I don't know, I think I was just too independent to actually farm in partnership with my family. And when a farm partnership agreement was produced one day on the kitchen table, I took one look at it and realized, I mean, I've made quite a few decisions like this in my life, but just on that moment, I just said, "Nope, I don't want this," and said, "I'm leaving." And I packed my bags and a month later, I was gone. I wanted to go and make my own way in the world. I went up to London and became a management consultant, which was may seem strange when, a week before I was milking cows, bought myself a snappy suit, and I had a first class degree from Oxford, which sort of opened a few doors, and I got a job, working for a management consultancy, and I worked there for a couple of years and had a fairly meteoric rise. And I think it was only about a year after joining, I was sent to New York to open their New York office. I mean, it seems incredible, doesn't it? But this was the 80s, and if your shoulder pads were big enough, you could do anything.
And that's such a huge change to leave that bucolic farm in Devon, which I'm very lucky to have visited, and make your way to London and then New York. Did you at any moment when you're in those big cities consulting regret the step you'd taken? Did you look back and think, I'm really missing agriculture, or had you moved on mentally at that point?
Yeah, I don't. I've never been that much of a sort of planner. I just sort of did it until I couldn't do it anymore. It was just making me miserable. I mean, I started taking way too many drugs when I was in New York because that was the lifestyle and it was fun. But it wasn't me. I was never happy doing all that stuff. And as a matter of fact, I was living with a girl on Union Square in Manhattan, and outside her apartment there was the Union Square Farmers Market. So I'm going back to the mid 80s now. It was very early days for farmers markets, and I found myself just chatting to the farmers there, who were the sort of radical pioneers of organics in the States. And that was where I felt at home, actually, and that was quite formative. So when I did eventually resign from my job, I went and sailed boats for a bit and then came back to the farm. That I think that shaped that was what I wanted to do, actually. I felt so much more comfortable talking to those farmers about farming and food than I ever did trying to flog the highly dubious services of the company that I worked for. So I think that sort of paved the path back to the farm, and indeed to dragging the plough out of the shed and ploughing up the first field where I grew my first organic vegetables in the winter of 86, 87.
And before we talk about that, the return home, just for those people listening who are either in management consultancy or thinking of going into management consultancy, what are your reflections of that job? Which sort of characters do you think it best suits?
Well, I can tell you what, actually, we spent a lot of time analysing markets for businesses that were in a, typically were making something which was going out of vogue. Maybe technology had changed and they wanted to move into another market, or maybe they wanted to buy a business in a different continent to get into a new market, and we would do the research around that. And actually, intellectually, it was really interesting and fun, and they seemed to be up for me being a sort of company maverick and take my own line on things. So all that I really, really enjoyed. What in the end led me to throw it in was that I regularly found myself required to lie to try and get information about what was going on in the marketplace. And I would like to think that this might have changed now, but back then in the 80s, this was just no one else that I was working with had an issue with this. And when I raised it as something that I wasn't prepared to do, I was regarded as a bit of a freak, really. So, I mean, I would say it was just morally bankrupt. And I suppose the upbringing I had from my parents was that that wasn't really good enough, that even if someone told you to do it, that you had a responsibility for your own behavior, especially as a relatively rich individual who had choices. So that was what really led me to reject it. I think I would have got fed. I didn't like the environment. I didn't like being inside. I didn't like the lack of tangible worth in what I was doing. But the thing that really ended it for me was the lying, the kind of moral bankruptcy. And I'm sorry if there are management consultants out here. It may have changed completely, and maybe then nobody does that anymore, but it was commonplace in the 1980s.
And so, Guy, talk us through then your prodigal son moment, going back home, and how that worked and how that felt. And you said there was a partnership deal on the table before you left. So what was it like for you to go back when you did?
Well, it was quite tough, actually. I mean, I got back. I had some savings. I had no support from my brother or my, I think my father gave me some moral support, but I had left and I had renounced my claim to the farm. So I had to start on a very, very small scale with a borrowed tractor. My brother wasn't massively welcoming, to have me back. Maybe he viewed it as, I don't know. Anyway, it did. It was difficult. I ended up living on my own in a damp cottage down the end of the farm with a fire that I had to light in order to in the morning in order to have a bath in the evening. I was a bachelor. I stank of cow shit, so I couldn't, work ridiculous hours and didn't have a girlfriend. And it was really, really tough. And looking back, I worked ridiculous hours, 70-hour weeks as a matter of course. And I was exhausted and I was miserable. And but I don't know, something really drove me on. And I mean, looking back on it now and having spent many hours in therapy in the intervening 40 years, I realized that my father was, withheld his approval almost to his dying day. And as he got older, as we both got older, he said, and I raised this as being an issue, he said, "Yes, son, but that's what drove you on." And so I think I sort of had to prove myself. And I realized those early years of doing the, working ridiculously hard was a lot of it was around proving myself to the world and in particular to my father, who did finally, on his in his approaching the end, pull me over to him and said, "Son, you've done well." And of course, I burst into tears.
Yeah, I can imagine. Your story there reminds me of a boy called Sue,
Oh, Johnny
the
Cash.
Johnny Cash song.
Yeah, I love
Yeah,
that song.
I've done it to make you tough.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, no, that's a very good comparison. I'll remember that one, Mark.
And so you've given us a very, very vivid picture, Guy, of those early years. So living on your own in a damp, small cottage and going out to your plot and planting your organic seeds and then getting the goods out of the ground. So tell us how you turn that into organic veg boxes and then how you built that. Just how did the story evolve?
Well, it was literally a borrowed tractor in a 3-acre field and, starting from a position of ignorance, really, because we hadn't, as a matter of fact, my brother had grown some vegetables on the farm, but we didn't, I hadn't grown up with vegetables other than helping my mother in the garden. So I had a lot to learn. I worked very hard. I grew a range of crops. Actually, I was remarkably successful looking back on it, considering my level of ignorance. And I sold them to local shops, most of whom didn't care that they were grown organically. But as over the years, the organic market from being a very tiny thing started growing. But mostly I just sold them on the basis that they were, super fresh and good quality. And as I say, to local shops and then local wholesalers and then wholesalers in London. And then, as it grew with this demonic drive that I had to prove myself, we grew, at, I don't know, first year was 3 acres, next year was 18 acres, I remember, and then 30 acres. And it was, it grew very, very quickly. I would, during the summer, I would often sleep by the side of the irrigation pump. I had this old tractor driving the pump that which would break down several times. And I used to just wake up when the tone of the engine changed and I knew I had to adjust it, sort of thing. It was extraordinarily hard work, but it was profitable from the beginning. I never borrowed money. I did have the family support in that I was able to then move on and take on more land. Without in a kind of incremental way, rather than having to make those huge step investments, which most businesses would have to take. And that was a huge help. So it grew incrementally as my skills and customers, grew. That would be through the 80s. And yeah, through the 90s, it was starting to get reasonably serious. And I started encouraging other local farmers to join. And in the end, we formed a cooperative of organic growers. I think that was in the mid 90s. And we started supplying supermarkets. which was, I have to say, Mark, the Waitrose were a joy to sell to.
I'm pleased to hear it.
Some of the others less so. Left me with I probably best we stay off that, Mark.
So in terms of, there are three questions that are in my mind about that phase of growth. The first was about the land, because you said I went from 3 acres to X acres to X acres. So just talk us through that, how that happened. The second thing I want to ask you is about help getting people who would come and work on the farm with you, because you get to the stage where you need people to support you. So how did you think about that? And the third, obviously, is your love life. What stage did you go from living by a pump to finding somebody who was prepared to tolerate your madness?
No, well, madness is not a bad word for it. Quite a few questions there, Mark. So the first one was the stages of development. I mean, it was quite a simple business in many ways. I was delivering vegetables out of the back of my car to start with, and then a beaten up old van, and then a pickup to local shops. I mean, I get so good. I think I always had a sense for the sort of marketing of it, because from a very early stage, I was persuading shops to put up boards explaining what organic was, and I guess probably about year five, my sister, who had worked in marketing in London for a bit, said, "What you need to be doing now, guys, developing a brand." And Mark, I can tell you, I had no idea what she was talking about. I mean, which in this, an era now where we're all surrounded by brands, and I think everyone's very aware of it. Back in the late 80s, it wasn't a thing, but anyway, I had to start developing this image of what my business was about and conveying it to my customers and potential customers. And somehow I think I've always been very good at that. I'm not quite sure why. But telling the story behind the food has been something that I've always been pretty good at. You asked about the people and having to, inevitably as it grew, having in, to employ people. Yeah, it did. I mean, to start with, it was friends and siblings and waifs and strays, of which we seemed to have quite a few around South Devon, and it was pretty ad hoc. And then I took on my first full-time employee, I think, and then my second one, who is still with me today, actually. I think from quite early on, I came to appreciate that businesses are really about people, and also that I had to try and find. I think I quite early on became appreciative of what I was good at and what I wasn't good at. And one thing I'm haven't been good at over the time is actually managing people. I'm a bit too inconsistent and perhaps a bit too impatient. And it's, I've had to learn the value of, positive feedback and so on. And actually the value of taking the time to give people, all the skills and information they need to be able to do a job properly, which I have to say my father was absolutely appalling at. He just believed that attitude was the thing, and if someone had the right attitude, they could do anything, and show them a tractor and a bag of seed and they'd be able to go off and sow a field, well, without any instruction about how to do it. I think I've inherited some of his faults, so it was really important to find people that were good with people. And actually one of that first employee who is still with me was very good at managing people, which was great because I could pass it over to him. And as the time's gone by and the business grew, it became more and more the case that I couldn't just lead by shouting at people or leading by example or whatever, that you had to sort of understand what this business meant to other people and make sure that they got what they wanted from it as well. And I think I'm quite good at understanding the importance of that. I'm much less good at actually delivering on it, because I think I have a short attention span and inherently probably quite impatient. But I did, I found other people to deliver those things for me. And I think Riverford's, it's been quite hard work sometimes. I think looking back over the years, in the early years, I always wanted it to be a good place to work, a fun place to work. I think I wasn't always that great at delivering on that. And I think probably I was too focused on growth and success and proving myself that way. And I think in the early years, I did neglect the well-being of my staff a bit. But I think I have corrected my ways, and I would urge anyone who finds himself in a position of leadership to invest some time in actually really getting to know yourself and getting to know what motivates you, why you're making the decisions that you do. And if you do that, you're going to be in a much better position to make decisions that are safe, both for yourself, but for probably more importantly, those that you work with, and perhaps, in the future for the environment and society at large.
And
And
there's
I'm
been
trying to say that was your second question, and your
yeah, no,
third.
and if I can just follow up on that, there's been a lot of talk, obviously, recently about the challenges with finding labour in certain sectors, hospitality, but also I know in farming. So how are you finding that now, finding people that are the right people for your enterprise?
Well, it's unquestionably a challenge. I mean, we have probably have more people working, probably have almost as many software engineers as we have picking vegetables these days. But if we just focus on what's going on in the fields, yes, it is very, the whole industry became totally dependent on East European labour, throughout the 90s and noughties, and right up to Brexit, really, and which was great in some ways. They brought a wonderful range of practical skills, fantastic work ethic. They were very easy to employ in some ways. The contract was very straightforward. They had pretty low expectations of how they were treated as human beings, which I'm afraid British agriculture probably did exploit a bit, and reverted to some fairly Victorian employment practices, which I we didn't, it was never more than a third of our workforce at Riverford, but we would have been lost without them. And many of them have stayed on after Brexit, but obviously, they're slowly sort of leaving or getting diluted. And it is recruiting local people to do what is incredibly physically demanding work in sometimes in pretty awful conditions is very difficult. And it's not just a question of money. I mean, it's not particularly well paid. I mean, we definitely pay more than most people and look after our staff better, but it is unquestionably becoming more difficult. And people, this time of year, July, we're super, super busy planting all the winter crops as well as harvesting and weeding all the summer crops. So we really need people who will work into the evening and work weekends. And that, for an East European, that was the. So we have eight Kenyans this year who are doing a lot of the planting, and we are, absolutely beholden to them. But I do have really mixed feelings about this, that our food is being produced by effectively a kind of underclass. And to me, this just seems culturally and socially wrong. I mean, but in the short and medium term, were that there to be no availability of migrant labour, British agriculture, and in particular British horticulture, would just decline even further than it has. I mean, we had another 5% decline last year, I think. There was a similar decline the year before that. Indeed, it's, British horticulture has been declining ever since I started in the 80s. And, we really need to arrest that decline. And without access to migrant labour, I think that's going to be very difficult. I mean, longer term, I think the whole industry, I mean, in my utopia, the whole industry would be restructured so that it was much more, smaller and medium-sized businesses rather than the, very large global corporations which have come to dominate all aspects of the supply chain. And, and agriculture is becoming increasingly specialized and scaled up, dare I say, in the case of poultry, pigs, and now increasingly dairy, industrialized. And I it's something that I deeply regret in the industry that I spent my whole life in and love it in, that I really don't like the way direction it's going, but I'm at a loss really to know how to turn it round.
And so, if you were to become the Minister of State for Agriculture, what would you do?
Okay. Well, our industry is to a large degree shaped by the requirements of its main customers, which is, of course, the supermarkets. And I would like to see much more honesty in the supply chain, so that people really did know where their food was coming from and how it was produced and by whom. You know, instead of that, we have, I'm going to say Tesco's because they are the worst offender in this case, I think have 7 or 8 fake farms, you know, so they say that their chickens come from Willow Farm. You know, Willow Farm doesn't exist. Well, it does exist. Actually, there are lots of Willow Farms, but they're not the Willow Farm, which is the brand owned by Tesco's, which sells chickens, you know, which the packaging would make you think had been were free range and that they were at least, you know, produced by a family farm, Willow Farm, or whatever. Are they hell? That, you know, they're produced by you know, a large global corporate, or at least the production is largely controlled by Cargill. So it's a complete lie, and I would like to see more transparency and honesty in the supply chain, such that a farmer who was farming in a better way, looking after their livestock better, looking after the environment, looking after their staff better, and doing it at a scale where they made a social sort of contribution in their geographic area, you know, could differentiate itself and could be identified on the shelf. We have the technology to do this, whether it's through a brand in itself or whether it's a barcode where you could go and find out about that product. But, you know, instead, we have a supermarket keeping farmers anonymous over there. And keeping their customers, you know, totally disconnected from those farmers at the other end of the spectrum, and they sit in the middle with all the market control. And I think this has been hugely to the detriment of British farming. And I know mostly about horticulture, but pretty much the same is happening across all other sectors. I mean, if you look at the consolidation in poultry, in pigs, and now in dairy, I think if most of the British public could really see how that food was being produced and understood the way that the supermarkets were shaping that food production, I think they would be appalled. So I think if there was honesty and transparency in the food chain, it would enable us to, it wouldn't, it would be a slow change, it would be a transition, but I think we could move towards a better form of agriculture.
Okay, well, thank you for that, Guy. Let's the third of my questions before I get on to
If I can just frame that, Mark, when we sold to Waitrose, I have to say they were just so different to the other supermarkets that we were selling to, and really were, they did have an honesty that which was really quite refreshing. I mean, I'm going right back to the early 2000s now. I've no idea what it's like today, but at that time it was very, very refreshing. But I mean, my understanding is that they found the forces that they were competing with, that they found it very difficult to maintain that level of decency. But and you probably know more about what happened after that than me.
I wish I did. And maybe that's for another conversation another time. But what I was keen to do before I ask you about all the tech side, because of course you have become a tech entrepreneur as well as a farming entrepreneur, I just want to ask you about the personal cost. So I framed it earlier about saying my third question was about your love life, your romance. So talk about that, the personal pressures and trade-offs that you make and you made, and how you resolved all of that in your life.
Yeah, well, my father was a probably pretty much a workaholic who his only other passion was sailing, and he'd disappear for a couple of weeks a year and go sailing, but mostly it was just work, 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 work. You know, I followed in his footsteps, so I did marry at 30 and had children, 4 children, and through their early years, you know, I put a, you know, I say with some regret, but you know, the farm had the best of me, really. When my first child came back from hospital, you know, with my wife, and the irrigation pump broke down, and I instead of, you know, I just in my crops were going to die, I went out and stripped down the irrigation pump and got it going again. And I remember the midwife coming down and round and tearing me off a strip, you know, much for abandoning my wife, you know. So I was, yeah, as I say, the farm got the best of me. And my younger children, I think, as I the pressure came off a little bit as the business developed, got a bit more of me. But I it was, yeah, there were considerable, you know, personal sacrifices, which I do, you know, which I think my parents, sorry, my children and my marriage bore the brunt of, and I do say that with some regret. I mean, I guess if I hadn't been so committed, I wouldn't have achieved what I have done. It's a balance. I guess I think I probably would defend the choices that I made because I got there in the end, and I have a now have a fantastic life, a fantastic autonomy, and a fantastic second marriage, and I have pretty good relationships. I've recovered the relationships with my children on the whole, and I have a stepdaughter now, and I absolutely adore all five of them, and I got there in the end, but there was a fair amount of pain along the way, which perhaps I could have managed my life better.
And so let's talk now about you being a tech entrepreneur. So you started to ride the internet really from the start. You said about your sister seeing the opportunity for you to create a brand, and you created Rutherford Organic, and then you had your veg boxes delivered locally, and then, of course, nationally. So just take us through the whole tech journey and how you found that and how you grew it.
So I think we delivered our first veg box in 1993, and by the late 90s, we had our first website, and I think we developed our own database. There was no, you couldn't buy the software in that way. We had to have it written for us. I was incredibly lucky. I had a guy called Martin Swarbrick, who took care of all this for me and let me go on with growing the vegetables. And he was one of those sort of multi-skilled persons, people who seemed to be able to do anything. And not only did he organize the database and the website, he actually also got us into franchising, which is actually how we delivered the boxes for 20 years or something, which was pretty successful at the time. So we did evolve from where the key skills were, growing a good field of potatoes, to the key skills being able to manage a database and design a website and have a good customer experience through all that. That was a transition which, I don't know, I was quite, I had no enthusiasm for it. Actually, I did at the start with the internet. I was very excited by its democratization, or the potential for it to be a force for, democratizing the world and whatever. It certainly has turned out to be anything but that, I would say, in most instances. But at the time, it was very exciting. But, really, all I wanted to do was grow vegetables. And, I didn't want to sell them to supermarkets anymore, so I had to find another way to sell them. And the veg box was a great way of doing it. I loved it when I actually met the customers and they really valued what they were getting and they cared about how we were growing it, very much different to how you were treated by a supermarket buyer. So that was great. But I was quite reluctant. I think I can tell you it wasn't until two, well, it was well in, I think it was about 2015 when I actually remember standing at a board meeting and saying, we are internet retailers, and these are the skills that matter, and we better catch up. And this is what matters more than growing potatoes. And we did, after in the end, employ an incredibly clever guy out of the IT industry called Roger, who helped us, catch up with what was going on around us with the IT, which had become so important to the business. And under his reign, we stopped using the companies that were just ripping us off, who were writing our software and so on, and employed people to do it ourselves. And that really turned the business round. And without that, I mean, I think we'd already had two failed website launches, which had really brought us to our knees and threatened the future of the business. So yeah, no, it was a transition, and it was a completely chaotic transition. I mean, managing something that you know nothing about is really, really difficult. And I would say the management skills, in many areas are transferable, but there are two areas in life where I found they are definitely not. One is in running restaurants, which I have some experience of. Never try and run a restaurant unless you know about running a restaurant. It is one of those specialist things that you will be taken to the cleaners. And the other area is IT. If you don't know about IT, I mean, really trying to manage a team of IT professionals who have no respect for people who don't know more than them about this area, you know, you're going to find difficult. So that was, and it was, we had quite a hard journey of catch up. In fact, I think the chaos started in about, as I remember, about 2005 and continued almost until 2015, when we were really struggling. Just, you know, the business was growing very quickly. Everyone's expectations of the internet were also growing. Whatever you did this year was no good next year. And it, you know, it was just hugely demanding and stressful. And we were managing these people who were really doing their best, but, you know, who were working in our IT department. I mean, they were out of their depth as well. So it was, yeah, it was a very, very taxing, stressful time.
And that kind of takes us, that journey into tech, takes us up to the moment when you gave virtually three quarters of the business away at a knockdown price to your employees. So effectively, you sold the business for about a quarter probably of what it was worth to your employees. And as I said at the start, you finished that off in May 23 by selling the rest again at a knockdown price. So what was it that drove you to that quite amazing philanthropic act to have built this amazing business from you in a damp cottage with 3 acres to having lots of acres and a big internet business and being so well regarded for what you've achieved? How did you end up thinking, actually, I know I'm going to pass this to all the people who work in this business?
Well, I'm one of those people who do their thinking off on their own. You know, I do listen to other people, but then I go off on my own and I have to sort of figure it out for myself. So, and that, in my case, that would be working my way up a row of lettuces, hoeing them or planting them or something, which I still do today at 64, you know, as a multimillionaire. That's still where I go to think. I mean, I'll go and do something practical and repetitive. So working my way up those lettuce rows, I started thinking about what sort of world I wanted to live in, actually. And I wanted my business to be run in a way that contributed to that. And I suppose I've probably always, I mean, I alluded to my parents' values, but I probably always had a political view somewhat to the left of centre, but not conventionally socialist, I suppose. I do also like business and respect what business can bring, but I didn't like the way most businesses were run, and, you know, i.e., solely for the benefit of the shareholders, you know, developing shareholder value. And, you know, if we are honest, that's how businesses are run. I mean, that's more or less corporate law in most instances. There are a few restraints on it now with, you know, the additions to the report that you're, but you know, that's pretty much the truth of it. And I didn't like that. I didn't, especially as my business grew bigger, and I could look around and I see its success was the result of lots of people's efforts and the loyalty of my customers and, you know, the hard work of the other businesses that were supplying Riverford by that stage. So I started thinking about, you know, I wanted a business, and also was starting to get a bit familiar with the behavior of boardrooms by that time. And basically, I didn't like it. You know, I like businesses that are where the decisions are made by the people who are doing the work. And in many instances, I think the closer they are to the action, the better decisions they'll make. So all these things were going round in my head as I was hoeing my way up and down the lettuces. And I was sort of starting to design my sort of utopia, I suppose. And I came up with a model in my head where the business was owned by, yeah, the customers, the suppliers, the staff who worked within it. And then I met, in a shout out to the John Lewis Partnership, I then met your chairman, Stuart Hampson, wasn't it? Am I going getting it right? In about 2001, I was at the Royal Show and he was presenting me with an award. I can't actually remember what it was for. And we struck up a conversation. I must have started alluding to my views on business. And he said, well, you should try, you should look at employee ownership. And he sent down, I don't know whether you ever met Ken Temple,
Temple.
who, he said he came down a couple of times to talk to us about employee ownership. It was very helpful. And we started thinking about, I also went and visited several workers' cooperatives. That was too radical for me. And so I decided I wanted to go for employee ownership. And that was, I'm guessing that was about 2005. And round about that time, we just hit a brick wall. As I said, I was saying earlier about our IT and failed websites and so on, which really took 10 years out of my life. And it wasn't until 2015 or whatever that we'd sorted those things out and that we were actually in a position to proceed with the employee ownership. In fact, it was Rob, our CEO, and Charlotte, our change director. I remember them over lunch today, one day saying in about 2015, come on, Guy, you've been talking about this employee ownership for long enough. Are we going to do it or not? And I said, hell yeah. Yeah, of course we are. Yes, we're going to become employee owners. So they said, well, when are we going to do it? And I said, well, we're going to do it in the next 3 years. And indeed we did. I think we became employee owned in June 2018. And it was the result, the culmination of a tremendous amount of work. In particular by Rob and Charlotte, actually going out and researching and visiting other companies, employee-owned companies, and finding out, you know, what made them work, what the problems were, consulting with our own employees, finding out what they wanted. I think we did it in a really, really good way. We did it patiently, we did it with lots of consultation, and really I give almost all that credit to, in particular, you know, Charlotte, because as I've said earlier, I'm not the most patient and painstaking and detailed focused person. And it was so when we eventually did become employee owned in June 2018, when my father was still alive, actually. And he was very, very supportive of it. And it was one of the best days of my life. It was, you know, and I still look at the photographs of that day and celebrate them and you know, immensely proud of it. I mean, for those who are listening to this and not familiar with employee ownership, I would say the two key elements, and I hope you agree with this, Mark, are that you are giving your employees, co-owners, as we now call ourselves, a meaningful say in the decisions and the future of the business. And we have various democratic governance structures for achieving that. And that they get a share in the profits, which they do. And last month, everyone got 1,600 quid tax-free, in addition to, you know, as a share in the profit. We hope over the years that might increase further. And it has just, I think one of the most important things for most people at work is to, you know, is to have some sense of sort of autonomy that they are actually, you know, to some degree, you know, in control of their own lives and their own destiny. And I think if you ask most people, most of the co-owners at Riverford today, they would say, you know, that they do and that they are supported and that they do feel part of. I think in particular, or something I hear over and over again, is that they feel part of shaping a small bit of the world to be a little bit more like the world that so many of us want to live in.
And if finally you were giving a piece of advice to a business owner out there about considering or going employee owned, what would you say to them?
Well, give yourself plenty of time, be patient, do lots of research, and make sure that you consult widely, that you do actually go and talk to your staff. This is not something to impose on people. Actually, I think John Spade and Lewis did slightly impose it on his co-owners, I gather. And that is very, very common. I've heard a lot of businesses that have done it in that way. And I think it's a big mistake. It's really, really, really important to consult and make sure that the staff are part of the journey. And because it's not just about governance and legal documents, it's about culture. And they need to be part of that. And actually, the model that we eventually took, which is indirect share ownership, where the shares are owned in a benefit trust, was largely the result of, you know, broad consultation with our staff. And right from the beginning, I was just absolutely astounded by the level of sophisticated thought that people who you'd think, you know, didn't have a lot of education, certainly not business education, but were able to, you know, for instance, something we were asked over and over again, isn't all this consultation going to slow up decision making? Isn't it going to make us less flexible and responsive? Which I think is really quite a sophisticated, you know, thought pattern. And this was coming from people who had no experience of, you know, managing businesses and so on. So, and to this day, you know, we find that the input of consulting widely on, you know, whether it's pay or, you know, conditions or whether we should stay focused or become diversified, you know, all those sort of big questions, you know, actually consulting widely and it has it's really helping us, you know, make better decisions. And you know, and then the very detailed things about how we drive more efficiency out of the business. Well, that's definitely, as so much of that has come from the shop floor, from, you know, innovations that people have made on a very local scale. So I am a big fan of employee ownership, and I would really urge anyone considering the future of their business and maybe their exit to at least have a look at it. It's, you know, it's not going to be for everyone, but I mean, it's just so wonderful. I now farm, you know, 2 miles up the road, and to be able to come to Riverford and feel proud about, you know, what's going on there and proud of the engagement of the co-owners is not something that many people who sell their businesses are able to feel. Most people who sell their businesses end up pretty upset, in my experience. They don't like what happened to their business. I mean, Riverford is a very personal thing to me. I view it as my sixth child. You know, it is as personal as that. And to just sell it to, you know, I've got approached by numerous venture capitalists and so on. You know, it would feel like selling a child into prostitution. I do feel that strongly about it. Whereas at the moment, it feels like, you know, passing. Well, actually, no, I'm not going to say it's not like passing a child on to, it's like helping a child grow up. That's what I feel I've done, and setting it free and loose and putting it in a position where it can realize its potential, which is what I see Riverford doing today.
Well, that's an inspiring way to finish this podcast, Guy. You have had a remarkable business life through just sheer hard work and adversity at the start, and what you did to build your business, to growing the scale, going online, and then the amazing philanthropic act at the end, where you turn Riverford Organic into an employee-owned business. So thank you for sharing all of that with me and all of the listeners on this podcast. I know they'll have hugely enjoyed listening to your story. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
To listen to more episodes and find out how to get happy in your working life, head to workall.co. Work happier.